Starting up a business is hard, really, really hard. Your chances of failure are high. You're likely to lose both your sleep and your hair. But luckily for you, you're not alone. Welcome to ET Startup School, your step-by-step guide to starting, building and consolidating your startup business idea. Your teachers at the ET Startup School will be some of India's best-known entrepreneurs, VCs and domain experts. So grab a notebook, pay close attention, school is about to start. Today's class at ET Startup School is called How Do I Prioritize Spending? Your teacher for this class is Varun Alag, co-founder and CEO of Honasa Consumer, the parent company of Mama Earth. Mama Earth is a direct-to-consumer baby and skincare products company that was founded by Varun and his wife Ghazal in 2016. They turned unicorn in 2022 and are currently all set to launch their IPO. Making money is tough, but spending it wisely is just as tough. So here's Varun Alag to tell us more about the subtle art of spending money and spending it well. All right, Varun Alag, CEO and Chief Dad of Honasa Consumer Private Limited, the parent company of Mama Earth, welcome to ET Startup School. Varun, for this class on ET Startup School, let's assume that I'm an entrepreneur. I've achieved some sort of product market fit. I've bootstrapped for a while, raised money from family, friends and schools. I've also managed to raise some either pre-Series A or Series A funding. Right? I have a little money in the bank. What should be my spending priorities?
Hey, hi. Firstly, thank you for having me on the podcast. If you have managed to reach till this milestone, I'm assuming you've got your product market fit, and, which is where you've seen early signs that the need that you're trying to fulfill and your product is able to fulfill that need, and people are willing to pay money and for that need as well. And in my mind, those are the two most important sort of parameters. And the third parameters that you need to look for is, are people who are using your product or service and referring you to others and are willing to refer you to others, which is measured by an NPS, but rarely in true business sense is measured when actual referral is happening, and you don't need to apply unnecessary push, but your product or service is creating that right pull. So now that you're at that PMF stage, I think from a spending priorities perspective, I would say the first thing that I would spend on is building a team for tomorrow, because from now to the next couple of years is what one refers to growth years. And if you need to grow that fast, you will actually need a team who you can envision running that business 2 years down the line. You will need to hire for tomorrow rather than hiring for yesterday, which you might have been doing till now, given you were bootstrapped and you had lesser money. So I think first priority will be getting my team in place. And second priority will be recognizing clear growth levers or funnels, which I have experienced over my previous journey, and saying, okay, if I had to spend money to grow faster, these are the three or four funnels. Could be marketing funnels, could be, you know, B2B sales funnels, whatever is the funnel that you've built. And you've experienced working for you. And the second place where I'll put in money is to ensure that the growth comes in now. The sad thing would be if you've crafted your PMF and someone else comes and sort of copies that PMF and actually ends up growing faster than you. And that also needs to be protected. So it's a fine balance between, going slow and conserving capital and losing the opportunity that was in front of you. And hence, I'd figure out the growth levers and double down on them. And I think the third thing that I would do is just make sure that the infrastructure which is required for an organization to grow outside of people, right, is also something that I'm investing in. And the infrastructure could be varied from technology infrastructure, could be about, the right, tools which track your processes. So if you're a B2B SaaS company, then investing in the right CRM, which can, track your sales funnels, or if you're a consumer company, then investing in right data you know, tools so that you can monitor what's happening, and or investing in the right kind of shopping stack. So I think whatever is the process and infrastructure required to actually make sure that the growth you bring in, you have high visibility on where it is coming from and how you can further expedite it, right, is the third area where I would invest.
Varun, as an outsider, when I see a startup that's funded, there are some signs you outsiders can easily see. One, you'll see a nice fancy logo designed by a premium design firm. You might see a fancy office. You might also see a brand ambassador for a B2C business, a Bollywood celebrity or some other sports celebrity. How important are these from a signaling perspective and a utility perspective, both?
So I think firstly, you know, all of these have to be seen. Everything in business needs to be first seen from a utility perspective. And I mean, of course, if you didn't have a good logo, you should get a good logo. It is, but you can get it on Fiverr for like $10 as well, right? It is not that you need to like go in for seriously expensive French boutique agencies to get your logo right, right? As a founder, you have a certain sense of what do you want to stand for. From an office perspective, and again, you know, at the stage that you are talking about, and functional utility is far more important, and but it is an important cog in the wheel, right? From a perspective of being able to attract the right talent, and if you're in a unhygienic, difficult to reach, and place which does not really inspire, innovation, confidence, energy, doesn't give that positive vibe, and it does end up impacting your work. And if it is not easily reachable, then attracting talent becomes an issue. It's not about fancy office, right? But from a utility perspective, keeping the next 18 odd months at least in mind, right, of your hiring plans, and right, ensuring that you have a space which is positive, which is reachable, where you can, you know, when you bring in an employee in an interview, it's not like they just go away from the door saying, oh my God, right? I don't want to work in this hellhole, right? So that functionality needs to be solved. And beyond that, you know, apart from having the right workspace where people can work, and you need to solve for certain meeting rooms, because not just you would need them for you to do meetings with, let's say, external investors or external people. It's not always possible to have certain confidential matters discussed on the floor. And you might want to sort of, you know, need a restricted space for that. And your teammates also might want to sort of, you know, do a lot of brainstorming. So they will need a space for that. So from a, and then, of course, some place where you guys can have lunch. And so as long as that utility is taken care of, right, that should be one, right, at this stage that you should be thinking about. And from a brand ambassador's perspective, I think that's a very sort of, you know, difficult to answer question, not knowing what the need of the brand is, right? Because finally, brand ambassador, the purpose is twofold. First being providing you clutter break in the media, which means that if you do plan to do television advertising, let's say, right, or print advertising, and how a brand ambassador helps is, you know, in the flurry of advertising, which is there in a newspaper or on the TV, and the face just helps get you noticed, right? And, you know, the second thing is if the DNA matches very strongly, right? If what they stand for and is what you stand for as a brand, and hence that natural fit and them just talking about you on digital media can help you spread the word. And that those are the needs with which you should evaluate that. And there is the only signaling which works for your company would be your performance as a business, right? All of this has to be seen from a business perspective, and they should further drive your business metrics. Right? And if they drive your business metrics, they are great investments.
In the previous answer, Varun, you used a term called NPS, which of course stands for Net Promoter Score. Yeah. What do first-time entrepreneurs need to know about this term NPS?
So NPS is actually a term which largely comes from the world of technology and tech products. So the question that is asked to you know, the users of a service or a product is, would you recommend this service or product to a friend or a family? Right? and you're supposed to rate it on a scale of 10. And net promoter score is basically 9 and 10 is what is defined as promoters. While anything under 4 is what is defined as detractors. Promoters minus detractors, divide by 100 in percentage, right, is your net promoter score. Anyone in between, which is those guys rated 5 to 8, right, really then don't matter, right? So it basically treats people who either love your service, right, or hate your service, right, because extreme emotions is what really captures, how your product is being liked or not liked, and tries to understand if people are willing to recommend it to a friend or family, right? That means you've genuinely made a difference to their lives, right? And that's a good metric to capture if you're getting word of mouth going or not, right? And your service or product is being loved or not.
Warren, what do entrepreneurs need to know about concepts like runway and burn rates? Runway, of course, is the amount of time that you have to achieve profitability, or is it revenue stability?
Not really. No. So let's start with burn first, right? So the first kind of burn is P&L burn, right? Which is basically that when you look at a P&L, right, what is the loss that you're making? The P&L loss, right, is what one refers to as the P&L burn. Now, in very simple terms, that's the monthly loss that you're making. Right? But the more important burn to actually keep track of, right, is what we refer to as cash burn, right? Which really comes from the cash flow statements. Right? So while your P&L burn might be 100, right, but let's say because your working capital cycle is 90 days or 120 days, right? Every month as you grow, right, you require that if you were 100 and now you're 200, right, you require incrementally 400, right, to actually get that 100 rupee monthly growth, right? And that finally adds to the cash requirement that the business has, right? And hence cash burn, which includes how your working capital is tracking, right, is a far more important metric than P&L burn. And this cash burn is what decides your runway. Right? So for example, if you had 10 crores in your bank, right, and your monthly cash burn is 1 crore, right, then you basically have a runway of 10 months. And so runway is basically the number of months, right, that the company has, right, with the capital that they have to survive. If they are either not able to convert themselves to profitability, right, or if they are not able to raise more capital, right, basically at the end of the runway, then you either fly or you go boom. Right. So that's how the runway is defined.
And what are the components of P&L burn? What are the elements?
P&L burn is very simple, right? You have revenue, you have your cost of products, then you have, which is, revenue minus cost of products is usually what you get as gross margin or gross profit, right? That minus your cost of marketing or demand generation that you put in, right, leads to contribution margin, right? And that minus your operating costs, which is like OPEX, salaries, rents, right, etc., is what leads to EBITDA. Largely, below that is what you have: depreciation, interest, amortization, right, which leads to your net profit, right, which is what is the profit before tax, PBT, right, and then after tax is PAT. Right, but if it is negative, then PBT is where it ends. Right, so that P&L burn is the PBT.
As a startup founder, what's a good rule of thumb to follow when you're planning for both capital expenditure and operating expenditure?
So in my mind, the good rule to follow would be avoid capital expenditure as much as possible. Operating expenditure instead of it. So for example, instead of buying laptops, right, try and take it on lease. Right? Because, one, you don't know how long you're in this. Right? Two, paying that whole amount upfront, right, is just going to then reduce your runway. Right? Three, you don't know if technology changes and you might need a different machine in 1 year. Right? 4, you're not in the business of buying and selling laptops, right? You're in some other business that you're running, right? As long as you're not in that business. If you are in that business, better buy laptops and sell laptops. But it's just an example. So if you can push CapEx in any form out and replace it with OpEx, even if it is a few percentage points higher in terms of the overall spends that you're doing, and the optionality that you buy by pushing out time is of very high value in startups, right? And hence, wherever it is not very strategic, right? I mean, in certain cases, some things are very strategic. You need a specific manufacturing machine, right? To get something right, right? And nobody has the technology in India, so you need to set it up, right? Now, hey, this becomes strategic then, right? Without that, your business can't happen, right? But in any other circumstance, right? Why would you buy an office when you can lease an office? Why would you buy laptops when you can lease? I mean, in all the other scenarios, you should try and do OPEX rather than CAPEX.
How do you track spending at Mamaearth? What are the metrics or dashboards that you use?
Last, we had 126 different dashboards which were being used by...
That's a lot, even for a CEO.
No, so by the way, I know, I probably see two of them. Right? It's just that the organization is very data-oriented. We are very, very sort of hell-bent of taking decisions basis real crunchable data. And the good thing is because we have such strong direct-to-consumer connects, right? We get a lot of data, right? It's just about crunching it, right? From my perspective, at my level, I would look at the core health metrics, which is there in the business. I mean, the different parts of business, P&L that I talked about, even that divided into like CM1, CM2, CM3. Right? And then I would look at how, those same ratios are trending at different brand levels now that we have 6 different brands, right? How they are trending at different channel levels now that we are available in 6 to 7 different channels, right? If there are certain large customers, seeing them at those customer levels, how those ratios are sort of panning. And growth, of course, is an important ratio that you, where is it coming from? What's the tree? Then those are hard business metrics. Right? And then in our business, for example, we also have brand metrics that we track, right? How is your brand love score? How is your preference? And we run separate independent external brand tracks to do that. How is your household penetration? What's your market share? And so you would track some of the what you can call consumer metrics or how metrics. And then the third set of metrics that I would track is the employee and partner engagement metrics, right? Which is, again, we run different pulse surveys, great place to work, etc. To measure what people are feeling, which kinds of, we also now have these chatbots which give us weekly sort of feeds on how functions are feeling, how individuals are feeling, and are there necessary actions which need to be taken. So I think those three kind of metrics is what I look into.
Varun, there's one school of thought that believes that all businesses are tech businesses because the investment in tech for any kind of business is pretty significant. So assuming I've got a little bit of funding and I've got reasonable product market fit, should I start looking at services like Amazon Web Services right away? Or is there a ramp up? I should use a cheaper service and then eventually move up to something like that? Or should I aim for the most reliable and the biggest brand name in the market right away?
Technology is complex. And I mean, it just depends on what business are you in. And now, for example, if we want to keep the scope to, let's say, an e-commerce business, and you have firstly option of build or deploy, right? Now, if you're deploying, there are solutions like, Shopify, WooCommerce, right? And they have very strong ecosystems, right? Where as a part of one holistic platform, right? which is like a Lego, right? There are bricks available and you can build your own platform and you don't really require deep engineering strength to do that. And someone who has product knowledge and a bit of the platform knowledge can themselves do it very quickly. And now, in case of deploy options, and the server cost is also taken up by the deployer, which is Shopify in this case. And as long as you can manage with deploy, you should first scale that, right? Because that then allows you to focus on other more important sides of your business. And this is being managed by people who know how to run and build this really well. And then you might reach a scale where you do realize that, technology is now a strategic differentiation for us. For example, for us, tech is clearly a strategic differentiator now. And which is why almost 2 years back, we started building an extensive engineering team, data science team, etc., who then built the right technology stack for us. We've now built a lot of different products which help us, do our business better. But then that's a strategic commitment. It's a strong investment that you need to sign up for. And it's also not a short-term investment. You can't take like a four-quarter view. You have to take a 12-quarter view into that investment and how it will pay off. From a question of, once you've made that investment strategic in nature, you don't want what we call tech debt, which means that, making wrong platform or product choices, actually, they might be cheaper today, but the debt that they create in 12 months because of the amount of time you require to fix some of those things later on is so high that actually net ownership cost is ends up being higher. So you should evaluate and go for products that you truly believe in. There are multiple now, and no one is lesser than others. For example, be it a Google or a Azure or a AWS, right? All three are great, platforms, right? And almost all three do give startup credits, right? There are certain credits which are available for any startup that wants to apply. And then there are certain large set of credits up to the tune of $100,000, right? Which you can get if there is a certain, kind of VCs who are investing in you. Right? And a lot of VCs have that program side. So you might want to check with your investors if they're part of any such program, right? And get yourself some of these, credits.
If I've raised money from a VC, let's say pre-Series A or Series A, does the VC typically oversee every rupee I spend, or do they give you broad guidelines and let you as the entrepreneur do the spending?
Of course. see, VCs are very tight in small organizations in terms of number of people. If they are needing to oversee everything that you're spending, there is something very, very wrong here. And at least in my experience in all the good companies and startups that I've met, young or old, right? The VCs can at best offer guidance, right? You can bounce your thoughts with them, and they can share learnings from what others have done that have succeeded or failed, right? They can make connections with the right kind of networks, right? And of course, they bring the capital for growth, right? But you're supposed to make your own decisions. You're the only one whose skin is really in the game, right? Whose neck is on the line, right? And you're supposed to take all your spending decisions and be responsible for them.
One of the spending decisions you're going to have to take is to whether to pay yourself a salary as an entrepreneur. So once you get funded, should you pay yourself a salary, and what kind of salary should it be?
No, I strongly believe you should pay yourself a salary. I'll also tell you the logic of which how you should probably, at least in my case, how I figured out an objective way to figure out what that number should be. But from a spirit perspective, you're not doing justice to your P&L if you're not putting your salary in the P&L, right? Let's say you're four of you as founders, right? And you're doing critical jobs in the company. Right? Now, if those critical jobs were to be done by external folks, right, you will need to pay them to do that. Right? And there'll be a certain P&L dent that will come in the P&L because of that payment. Right? Because of which it is one fair representation, right, by paying some salary to you. Right? And I'll arrive at that sum. But secondly, it's also important that you're not feeling like you don't even have money for lights on at your home, right? I mean, if you're not personally, at least settled, right, from a perspective of you have money to do the basics, right? I'm not talking about luxuries, right? The basics that finally will affect your work, right? And you don't want anything affecting your work, right? And from a logic perspective, the logic that I had applied was your founder salary should be the position's market salary into, or your possible market salary when you're very early starting, and then the position doesn't have any market salary, right? I mean, who will want to become CEO of a two people company? But then you have a market salary, right? If you wouldn't have been doing that, you could have been doing something else, right? Your market salary into one minus, right, your ownership.
Oh, can you explain that again? How does that work?
For market example, salary minus? You believe your, you know, your current market salary is 40 lakhs. Right? But your ownership currently in the company is 90%. You own 90% of the company. And then basically 40 lakhs into 1 minus 0.9 or 1 minus 90%, right? Which is basically 10% of 40 lakhs, right? Is what you should be taking at this point of time. And now you grow, and the organization reaches Series A. Now, potentially you have market salary could also be from a perspective of that position, and that you could effectively hire a CEO today, and you would need to pay them X, right? Yeah. Now, whatever is that X, right? And that X would be combination of, let's say, fixed as well as, you know, variable and possibly ESOP, etc. Whatever is that X, right? Again, one minus your ownership. Now your ownership might be 50%, right? Now that 50% into you know, that market salary, and is what your salary should be. So I just arrived at that objective way of sort of, you know, giving some science to this, and because I was myself also very uncomfortable, ki yaar ye kaise arrive kare, what should the number be,
and yeah, and it is a tough question. Yeah,
finally this is how I arrived at saying that this is the right way, because your ownership has a play in this whole thing, right? Because you have disproportionate ownership, and right, you're also driving value through that, right? And hence that should affect your today's composition as well.
Another spending decision that entrepreneurs might have to make is let's assume you have a pool of money, you've raised some money. You can either give value to your suppliers or to your customers. The classic case is Uber. They can either give money to their drivers or give discounts to their customers. How should you navigate this decision? Should you pass on value to your suppliers, your customers, or both? And money is, of course, limited. So what do you do?
Well, you can keep it to yourself. Right?
Best option.
And make profits. Right? But kidding aside, I think you should do whatever is the most sustainable thing to do. Okay. You should not start something which you feel later on, right, will become a big albatross across your neck, and you actually won't. It's not just that you won't be able to sustain it, but when you pull that back, and right, suddenly you'll see that it was a house of cards and things fell. There is no, like, you know, especially because of the example that you've taken, and there is no right answer, and the answer would lie somewhere in a balance, right, where you'll share it with both the suppliers as well as your customers, right? But whatever you do, the move should be sustainable in the longer term and not create a base which becomes completely unsustainable.
Varun, it's been said that during the California gold rush, the only people who made money for sure are those who sold spades and shovels. The modern day equivalent seems to be the tech giants, Google, Facebook, Insta. No matter whether you make money, don't make money, you're funded, not funded. Digital and online and social advertising is pretty expensive.
It is.
How do you allocate money to this? And some of it is brand, some of it is performance. All of it may not show results. Give us a couple of quick rules of thumb for entrepreneurs who need to advertise on these platforms or use these platforms for promotion.
Look, there is no sort of, you know, hard and fast rules here, right? I mean, everything firstly starts from your growth ambitions. You can also choose to sort of, you know, in expensive times or when things are too high, especially CPMs, right? You can also go choose to grow slower, right? And say, okay, when this stabilizes a little is when, you know, we would double down. Right? But finally, one, I think you have to be ROI oriented, and you have to look at, okay, what's my ROI from the funnel? What is my CPM? How do I get it better? What is my CTR? Can I deliver better creative content and improve the click-through rate, right? What is my conversion on my website? If 100 people come, how many buy? How can I get, you know, more people to buy from the website, right? And continuously keep working on that funnel to bring more efficiency in your acquisition costs. Because the external reality is external reality. I mean, it's not changing. What's in your control is how you manage this funnel, right? And when you put the, you know, the throttle button on and off. Again, I don't think there is a silver bullet which I can say, okay, itna percent we should have.
Unfortunately, no easy answers to this.
If you want to grow 300%, I'm sorry, but
you've got to spend like that.
Well, you need to spend like crazy, and Facebook will make money because they know you're desperate, right? And it's not like their people need to know it. Their engine can figure out if you're desperate or not. Right?
That's true. They're smart artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms that can figure it out. Okay, now speaking of external realities, what if a black swan event like COVID hit you? And this is not a hypothetical question because COVID actually hit you at Mama Earth. And you have a sudden change in logistics, you have a sudden change in costs, all your 12-month burn rate, your projections, everything goes out of the window. What did you do? How did you deal with it?
So I think firstly, you have to accept the reality. And you have to accept that you're in a new normal, right? And you have to create scenarios for if this new normal lasts for 12 months, 24 months, right? How do you need to relook at the business, right? Are there any underlying, you know, assumptions which have truly changed? Right? I mean, for example, if we take our example, there were certain underlying assumptions which had changed, which was, for example, ability to fulfill, right? Orders in online, ability to distribute in offline. So distribution clearly was disrupted, right? And you have to track that assumption, right? In a month, they added, for example, baby care and some of the personal care items into essentials, right? And again, the assumption changed. Now, through D2C, you would be able to run that, your own business, right? And then in another 2 weeks, your Amazons and Flipkarts also started sort of, you know, servicing a few PIN codes, right? Now you have another sort of distribution channel through which you can go in. After 6 months, right, everyone was talking online, right? Nobody was giving heed to the offline retailers while lockdowns were over, right? And offline retailers were open. Right? That was a great opportunity to go to the retailer because he was looking for brands who can partner with them and sort of give them some money to make, right? So I think tracking that underlying assumption, right? Now the positive assumption for us was a lot more people were coming online, right? But all advertisers had got conservative, right? Which means that CPMs were at their ever lowest. Right? We've never come across those low CPMs. Right? And hence, it was a great time to advertise, to acquire, right? Because the same amount of reach you were getting at one-third the cost. I think in any of these times, the other thing that you need to do extensively is communicate far more than you would usually do, right? Be it with your leadership team, be it with your extended teams, be it with your investors, right? You need to just communicate a lot more of what you're realizing, what is happening, what is changing, right? And, you know, keep sharing, right? Because you keep getting ideas from others, which are very interesting, and some things just click because you were communicating. And secondly, people are far more aware and ready for what to expect, right? So I think that was the third thing that we were doing. We were communicating a lot, right? And when we put all of this together, we realized, hey, this, given we had just raised and we were any which ways not a high burn business, right? You know, we just felt that this was one of those rainy days when you can overtake six cars instead of, you know, sunny days when you can do one. And, you know, we went all in, right? And we, in fact, tripled our business in 4 months during the time COVID hit, right? And that was just a big blip which kind of, you know, came in for us. So I think just, you know, by being cognizant of what's happening around you and looking at how underlying assumptions are changing, things just worked out.
You can actually spot an opportunity even in a crisis. Okay, Varun, thank you for all those learnings. A couple of personal questions for you, if you don't mind. Why is your designation Chief Dad?
So I think when we started the company, it was just me and Ghazal, you know, two of us who started this. And, you know, we were in the baby care business. We were starting it because of our son And we wanted to create a toxin-free personal care brand for babies. And it just sort of, with just two of us, it just didn't make sense. You know, how would designations work, right? I mean, what is the meaning of like CEO, COO at this stage when you're just two of you, right? So I think we just wanted to keep it light, and we wanted to reflect the actual purpose behind the brand, which is two parents who are coming together to sort of, you know, make a difference. And hence Chief Dad and Chief Mom, which by the way, even today our coffee mugs say that, and are just sounded like the right titles.
Okay. If I'm an entrepreneur, should I work with my husband or wife or partner? What's your advice there? What's it like working with your wife?
The biggest thing that you look for in a co-founder or a partner is trust. And second, I would say, is quality of communication. And I would assume that for most married people, these two would be far higher than anyone external that you might end up sort of, you know, choosing to work with. And so from that perspective, it's been very, very positive for us. And, you know, I don't think I would sort of, you know, trust anyone else more than her with my deepest vulnerabilities. And, you know, and which is how a co-founder relationship should be. I'm not saying that friends or brothers or any of those would be worse, but these are the two, three things that you should look for. And if you think between the two of you, be it, you know, relatives or you know, spouses, right, you have these two, which are very strong, and you'll figure out everything else. Don't listen to anyone and just start.
Varun Alag of Mama Earth, thank you for being a teacher on this class of ET Startup School.
Thank you for having me.
So that brings us to almost the end of today's class at ET Startup School. If you'd like to be a good student, check out and do the homework assignment in the show notes. If you like the podcast, share it with family, friends, even your frenemies. ET Startup School is produced by Animesh Das with inputs from Anupriya Nair, Erika D'Souza, Arijit Burman, Shilpa Sharma, Harish Shavla, Govind Mundra and Vishal Bhandari. ET Startup School is available on economictimes.com and ET Play, as well as Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, JioSaavn, and Google Podcasts.